Good evening, Barneys. My name is Andrew. I'm one of the pastors here. It's my great pleasure to continue our series tonight in the Gospel of John. And we've tonight got up to John chapter 5, which I'm calling, "And on the seventh day, Jesus made enemies." The story so far, I think at the beginning of the series I said that the story, or the introduction, if you like, to John's Gospel is a little bit like the overture to a really good opera. I don't know how many opera fans we have. I'm married to an opera singer. This is the only reason I know this. The overture, it introduces the musical themes which will come up again and again throughout the opera itself. And we've had throughout the introduction to John's Gospel these kind of hints of themes, particularly the theme or the motif of light and darkness. And so that's why we've called this series Light the Dark. And it's also why we have these seven globes above the stage. Now, keen observers will notice that we had six for quite a while. That's because we broke one. There's no symbolism in that, I hope, at least. We now have back to seven, and there's seven because there are seven key signs throughout John's Gospel. Seven key signs are sometimes the first half of John's Gospel is actually called the Book of Signs, because there's seven signs, seven examples, seven incidents where Jesus' glory is revealed, where the light shines into the darkness. We had over here, light number one, we had, of course, the water into wine at Cana, where Jesus brings life and light to the party. Then we had the clearing of the temple, where Jesus confronts the institutional religion of his day. And then light number three, we had the healing of the royal official's son. I'm really hoping I got them the right way around. Yes, I think I did. The healing of the royal official's son. We've had these three kind of signs, Jesus' light shining into the darkness. But the question is going to be, how will the darkness respond? Will people embrace this light, or have they got used to the dark? And so we've seen this kind of dissonance appear. This dissonance kind of come into view. Kind of even in the overture, we had this hint. Verse 9, the true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. But then verse 11, there's the dissonance. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. There's this dissonance. This signals that this opera or this musical piece will be more Miles Davis than Miley Cyrus. Flat nines and sharp nines and all that kind of thing. All right, that's for like three musical nerds in the room, okay? That's not going to... Normally with illustrations, by the way, you're meant to explain something unclear using something clear. I think I just did that the other way around. But anyway, we'll move on. The point is some dissonance appears in the story. Will Jesus' own people receive him the way the Samaritans did 2 days earlier? Or have they, like Nicodemus and the other religious leaders, grown too used to the dark? And here's the question for today, and that's why we're calling today, "And on the seventh day, Jesus made enemies." As always, well, you know, as always, it's in two parts today, just to surprise you. Normally it's three. Today it's in two parts, which Joel's excited because that means it's a short sermon, hopefully. Two parts. Enter the healer, part one, enter the healer. Part two, enter the lawyers. Let's get underway with part one. Part one, enter the healer. If you're reading along in your Bibles, that would be fantastic. We'll open to John chapter 5, verse 1. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now, we're not told exactly which festival this was. If it was the festival of the tabernacles, then this would indicate to us that it was October 21 to 28 in the year AD 31. It's as good a guess as any, the Feast of the Tabernacles. That means it's 18 months, actually, since the first time Jesus was in Jerusalem with the whole making a scene in the temple thing. Verse 2, now there is in Jerusalem near the sheep gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Remember that number. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. This was an unofficial thing in kind of the folk religion of Judaism of the day. Officially, Judaism didn't really have any truck with this kind of folk religion, but the really kind of sick people who'd given up all hope, they would try anything, even the kind of aquatherapy of the ancient world, right? And remember, this is a whole bunch of sick people, chronically ill people, getting in a stagnant pool together without chlorine, right? So these were desperate, desperate people, hoping that, according to the folk religion, an angel would stir up the water and therefore they would be healed. Now we get to verse 4, though. You following along? What does verse 4 say in your Bible? Have a look. Anyone got a problem with verse 4? Does anyone have verse 4? No, I don't have verse 4 in my Bible either. And that's worth asking the question. Is it that the translators can't count? Or what's going on? And actually, I want to, if you'll indulge me, have a little bit of a kind of a tangent here. I won't go for too long, I promise. Actually, I can't promise that. I hope it won't go for too long. This tangent is important, I think, because, well, I'm reminded of a student that I met with last year who at that point was a Christian, but he wasn't going to be for much longer. And so he'd watched on YouTube some clips which explained kind of the human dimension of the Bible, the errors, the processes which brought the Bible to us, and that deeply disturbed him. In fact, it shattered his faith. You see, he had a Sunday school understanding of what the Bible was, theologically, which hadn't grown up to match what he was learning from history. Now, his Sunday school understanding of the Bible was that God wrote the Bible. That's true. And yet what he was discovering is that actually humans wrote the Bible, bringing with them all the humanness, the finitude, and the potential for error. And it shattered his faith. And I don't want that to happen to you. Because actually what he needed to do was to grow up in his theology. Because as Christians, we know that the Bible is from God, but we also know that that God is the type of God who uses ordinary humans and ordinary language and ordinary processes of transmission to get that message to us reliably. And so we're not shocked when we read the Bible and we discover things like verse 4. Just so you know, most Bible scholars, the reason why they don't include it, or in my Bible they include it as a footnote, the reason they do that is most Bible scholars are pretty convinced that it wasn't in John's original autograph. That's why they don't put it there, or they put it in a footnote. It's nothing kind of hugely controversial. It's not kind of some big secret covered up by the church. Verse 4 says, from time to time, an angel of the Lord would come down and stir up the waters. The first one into the pool after each such disturbance would be cured of whatever disease they had. This probably, almost certainly, wasn't in John's original autograph. That is, the version of John that John wrote. How do we know that? Partly because of this. This is a piece of papyrus discovered in 1952 in Egypt. It contains almost all of John's gospel, and it doesn't have verse 4. It dates from, I think, about 100 years or so after the original was written. And really, really dull people who do this for a living, called Bible scholars, have painstakingly dated and traced all the tens of thousands of copies of the Bible that we have to work out what probably was in the original based on those kind of studies. And what almost certainly happened is that the verse 4 wasn't in the original because all the earliest and most reliable manuscripts don't have this verse. What probably happened is sometime in the 5th century, someone scribbled a note in the margin of their Bible to explain to someone the whole thing about the water and the angel, and then somehow that got copied into future versions. An easy and innocent, I think, mistake to happen, and that's why it's not included. The thing is, this shouldn't startle us because it's a human book. It's also God's message, but it comes to us through ordinary language and ordinary people. It's a holy book. That is, it's something set aside by God for a special purpose, but it's not a magic book. It didn't descend out of the clouds. Anyway, I actually think the more I discover about the history of the Bible, the humanness of the Bible, the more confidence I have in it. Can I give you another example? I was just talking before with Bill Salih, who's downstairs guarding our door, about the... he has a PhD in John's Gospel, so why he's not up here preaching to you, that's a very, very good question. Amateur hour, people, it's good. We're talking about the discovery in the 19th century of the pool. Right? So archaeology has almost certainly discovered this pool. Which is interesting because before the 19th century when this pool was discovered, it's under St. Anne's Monastery in kind of the northeast part of the old city in Jerusalem. It's in exactly the right place. It matches the kind of the features which are described here. Before that, a lot of people assumed that John was kind of made up centuries later, kind of like biblical fan fiction, right? Kind of centuries later, inspired by, but not actually anything to do with the real John or the real events. And the reason they thought this is John is just too sophisticated to have been written by a Galilean fisherman, which, as I've said before, is offensive both to Galileans and fishermen. But we'll leave that to one side. The point is, they found the pool, which is really interesting, because that city was destroyed in AD 69. So how this fan fiction writer from centuries later has intimate local knowledge of a part of a city that was destroyed centuries earlier is a really good question. And one of the many reasons why I think this was written by John. Startling, I know. John's gospel. This is why you come to church, to hear crazy ideas. John's gospel, written by John. There you go. Anyway, we'll move on from the history. The scene is set here, isn't it, really? The pool, the sick people. The scene is set for us now to meet the most unlikable character in this story. And it's this guy, verse 5. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. You may remember Israel wandered in the wilderness for 38 years, looking to everywhere for help but to God. Maybe we're meant to think of them. But anyway, Jesus comes, sees him lying there in verse 6. When he learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Jesus takes this rather strange response as a yes and heals him. Verse 8, then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." And once the man was cured, he picked up his mat and walked. Now, this would be another happy Jesus Healy kind of story, except for the one detail that John has left out, because he's a good storyteller and he knows not to give the punchline away. There's one detail which means that one of these men, the healer and the healed, will walk away today having made enemies. And it's this. Verse 9, the day on which this took place was the Sabbath. And so we come to part 2, enter the lawyers. Things really de-escalate once the lawyers are involved. That's a life truth. Verse 10, it is the Sabbath, they said. The law forbids you to carry your mat. Jerks. For starters, this is a debatable point, right? Highly questionable interpretation of the Old Testament, right? The law, as we heard read to us in the reading from Deuteronomy, the law prohibits you from working. It says take a day off a week, right? Sensible advice. It doesn't prohibit you picking up the mat you've been lying on for 38 years because you're a cripple and going home because you're kind of excited about being able to do both those things, right? That's not the point. That's probably not what Moses had in mind when he commanded them to observe the Sabbath. But these guys, these kind of religious lawyers, I apologize to any lawyers or law students, I've was a law student once, so I feel like I can say this. These kind of religious lawyers have taken nitpicking to such an art form that they make our like Australian tax law look like child's play, right? They developed laws upon laws upon laws. But rather than kind of stand up to them in a what I imagine I would do, kind of an Aaron Sorkin-esque kind of speech back to them, he caves. He points the finger to the guy who made him well. Hero. Verse 14, except he can't find Jesus. Jesus has slipped away, he can't remember his name, and so verse 14, it's not until later when Jesus finds him at the temple and says to him, "See, you are well again, stop sinning or something worse may happen to you." Hang on, this seems a little bit out of character for Jesus, right? Less the kind of compassionate healer, more the grumpy emergency doctor at the end of the night shift, kind of a little bit of sick of sick people. And what's this thing where he's kind of blaming sick people for their illness, you know, stop sinning or something bad will happen. What's going on here? John leaves these kind of really good questions hanging in the air. We're in chapter 5. He leaves it hanging in the air until about chapter 9. Now, spoiler alert. I'm going to take us to chapter 9 just very briefly. In chapter 9, there's another person who is healed, this time a blind person. And the details are very, very similar, but the contrast couldn't be greater. You see, in that instance, Jesus refuses to tie sin, any individual sin, to any individual sickness. Right? So you can't say Bob's suffering, therefore Bob must have some dirty secret he's not told us about. Right? Jesus refuses to let them do that. And that makes sense of what the rest of the Bible tells us about this world we're in. Yes, sure, there is a general connection, a general structural connection between the presence of sin in the world and the presence of suffering in the world. But you can't draw a link between one individual person's suffering and say, well, they must be worse than the rest of you. Because actually, it often works the other way. Why is it that poor people are the ones who suffer in floods more than rich people? Answer, because the rich people make the poor people live in the floodplains. This world is broken, and the structural injustices, as much as anything, exacerbate that problem. So we can't draw a link between sin and suffering in this kind of easy way. Jesus won't let us do that. Justice will only come on Judgment Day. That's why it's called Judgment Day. There is no justice now. Now, I don't think many of us would be so insensitive as to kind of turn up at a ward at RPA and kind of start casting judgment on the sick people. Oh, must have done something pretty bad there, buddy. I don't think we'd do that. But I do think that subconsciously we fall into this thinking in our own minds. I think I do sometimes. Not so much with other people, but more with ourselves. We have this idea that if I do good, then I'll have a nice life, and if I do bad, I'll have a bad life. And if I think I've done good and life doesn't go my way, then I'm very cranky with God about that. Because God hasn't kept his end of the bargain, has he? You ever do this? You ever find yourself thinking, well, but hang on, I'm one of the good guys. God must be broken. God must have forgotten. God mustn't be real. And we need to inoculate ourselves against this type of thinking because it's just not what the Bible says. That's superstition. Right? Do good and the universe will go for you. The Bible tells us that this world is broken, and as long as we are in this world, we will experience that brokenness as much as anyone, probably. As Christians, God doesn't promise kind of a tractor beam to beam us out of the world so we don't have to experience the brokenness. He wants us to stay here. We have a job to do here, and as long as we remain in the world, we will experience this brokenness and this suffering. And there is no justice until Judgment Day. Please inoculate yourself against that. Because if suffering comes, suffering for many of us already is, and we think good life, nice life, good behavior, nice life, bad behavior, bad life, then we will fall away. Because God never promised that. Back to chapter 5 and our chapter 5 cripple. Remember chapter 9 cripple, good guy, chapter 5 cripple, we're not meant to like him. Now, we can't assume that this guy did anything particularly bad, although Jesus does tell him to stop sinning. So why is that? A friend of mine had a heart scare recently. He ended up in emergency, and basically the doctors told him, if you don't change your life, you'll be back here again if you're lucky. It was a heart scare. They told him that so that he would change. And I think Jesus knows, Jesus, the great doctor of the soul, knows that there's something wrong in this guy's heart. And so he wants this whole experience of suffering and then healing to be a wake-up call. Now, Jesus doesn't share with us what the sin is. He doesn't share with us what the worst thing could be. I suspect maybe it's even Judgment Day. But he wants this guy to use this as an opportunity to wake up. Will he heal? Will he heed the call? I doubt it. Tell you why. What would you do if you'd been sick for 38 years? Some guy comes along and heals you, and then some kind of religious lawyery people start having a go at you for picking up your mat on the Sabbath, all right? And ask you to dob in the guy, become a snitch. What do you say? Get stuffed. I'm not doing that. That's what the guy in chapter 9 said. He's like, you crazy? Get stuffed. That's what he told them. And he got thrown out of the synagogue for it. But he didn't care. He could see. Chapter 5 guy turns into a snitch straight away. Starts trying to find out, you know, who Jesus is and reports him straight in. Verse 15, the man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who'd made him well. Thanks for that. I don't think we're meant to warm to this guy. I think we're meant to see him as a foil for chapter 9 cripple. For chapter 9 blind guy, I mean. Anyway, regardless, Jesus is back on the hook. Jesus is back in trouble. And Jesus just needs to say the right thing and he'll be off the hook, right? He could work this out, right? It's kind of a minor infraction. It's a debatable point of the law. Probably if he plays his cards right, says the nice things, he can go, you can kind of go home at the end of the day. If you know Jesus, you know that's not going to happen. Verse 17, in his defense, get this, Jesus said to them, "My Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working." That's his defense, right? Yeah. That's a terrible defense for the people he's talking to. This is like a long time ago, maybe 10 years ago, I was called out of bed in the middle of the night to go and to sit with a kid who'd been arrested. He was at the police station. At this time, I was kind of volunteering very infrequently with a church group that would go and support homeless kids who've been arrested, right? Because they don't have anyone to go sit with them. It's kind of scary being arrested. So we go sit with them. Anyway, this particular kid, I can't remember what he'd done. It was like shoplifting or something relatively minor. But basically, general advice is just keep your mouth shut, right? Just don't say anything, okay? They start asking him about the shoplifting, but he proudly has a defense, which was, if I remember correctly, that he was currently driving a stolen car. So he couldn't have possibly been shoplifting at that time. And I'm just like, stop talking, please. Right? Even the duty sergeant was like, can you stop him talking, please, for his own good, right? And I feel like Jesus' friends at this point are like, Jesus, just stop making, no, stop talking. Right to remain silent, buddy, just don't. Because what he says lands him in so much trouble you wouldn't believe. All right, let's just break it down. Firstly, he calls God my Father. For a Jewish man in his time, that is just kind of inconceivable. Maybe you would refer to God as our Father, right? The Father of Israel. Okay, that's all right. Maybe if you really wanted to push it, you would call him our Heavenly Father. At least put the heavenly between the you and the Father. But he calls God my Father. And they correctly interpret this as, well, what in their eyes is blasphemy, making himself equal to God. But the other thing he does is his actual defense, as it continues, equates his work with the Father's work, kind of sealing the deal. To understand this, we need to have a little bit of an insight into how the rabbis thought in those days about the Sabbath. Remember, these religious lawyers were very concerned that everybody should keep the Sabbath, even God. So they had a puzzle on their hands, right? Which is this. God should keep the Sabbath, because everybody should keep the Sabbath. But if God is keeping the Sabbath, then on the Sabbath, who's sustaining the universe? Yeah. Yeah. And their answer was, no kidding, their answer was, because there's this rule that on the Sabbath you're allowed to lift things in your own home, God is always in his own home. He owns it all. Right? Brilliant, found you a loophole. Thank us later, right? That was their logic, all right? You see what Jesus says here? He says, well, I'm just in the family business. Right? God works on the Sabbath. I'm working on the Sabbath because he's my dad. And this is the family business. This did not go down so well, all right? Now they definitely want to kill him. Now, I'm going to leave us hanging a little bit this week. Because there is a question, is this true? Is this what Jesus means? How will Jesus respond to their allegation? Because it's not just that he's saying he's kind of up there with God. In their minds, to claim equality with God is to claim to be another God, right? To be independent like God. God doesn't depend on anyone, so by Jesus putting himself up there, is he making himself a different God? Is he the same God or a new God? Right? This question is still to be answered, and we'll be looking at next week. Mike is going to bring us the rest of Jesus' defense. And just, spoiler alert, Jesus points out that because he is the same God, because he and the Father are one and he only takes his lead from the Father, he's not a different God. He's not in competition with God, but they are one. And that is amazing because that means that if you get to know Jesus, then you get to know God as he really is. And that's great news.